KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. A Las Cruces city councilor hopes to take on incumbent Republican Representative Yvette Harrell next year. In depth, here's KRWG public media scholar Noah Race.
With issues such as immigration, climate change, and the economy weighing heavily on voters, Las Cruces Councilman Gabe Vasquez is running for the Democratic nomination in New Mexico's 2nd Congressional District.
I've decided to run for Congress because I believe that this district needs better. Housing is being increasingly unaffordable for the average family. The middle class is in decline. Folks can't afford health insurance. We are seeing the impacts of climate change ravaging entire communities. And I see a strong need for comprehensive immigration reform that Congress hasn't been able to get done for many, many years.
Being a first-generation American, Vasquez credits his grandfather and mother for allowing him to follow his version of the American dream.
That opportunity is something that I take very seriously, that weighs heavy on me every day that I wake up and when I go to sleep. I have a desire to do better for my community, to return the favor that I was given and the opportunities that I was given for my family. The United States was our future. And so I want to make sure that that opportunity exists, not just for Americans today, but also for immigrants.
Seeing the success of the border firsthand, Vasquez says he wants to promote collaboration between the United States and Mexico.
The U.S.-Mexico border in this district brings tremendous benefits, not just to New Mexico, but to the entire country. The border creates jobs. The border encourages friendly U.S.-Mexico relations. And the border is also represents the cross-cultural relationship that we have.
In 2019, the Santa Teresa Port of Entry ranked in the top 10 for the most goods entering into the United States. This means that Santa Teresa has a vital role in the local, state, and even national economy. But border business is not the only topic on people's minds. According to the Pew Research Center, 42% of all voters say that climate change is very important to their vote. Vasquez says there are already some good ideas out there on how to counter climate change.
We are in a tremendous climate crisis right now that we've never seen before, largely by our own doing, by releasing carbon and fossil fuels into the air for an extended period of time. And so, we have to champion a whole bunch of different policies to really mitigate the impacts of climate change. The electrification of our fleet systems, for example, across our federal government and even local government here like the city of Las Cruces. The electrification of residential developments. The electrification of commercial and municipal development so that we are limiting the use of natural gas and other fossil fuels and carbon-based fuels and replacing them with electric.
One major hurdle that Vasquez and these policies may face is in the oil and gas industry in New Mexico. 25% of New Mexico's general fund revenue can be attributed to the oil and gas industry. The industry also directly employs more than 11,000 New Mexicans, making it one of the largest employers in the state.
And we also have to make sure that we lay down the path to transition into renewable energy. And that means in places like the Permian Basin, where the economy is strongly dominated by fossil fuel extraction, that we prepare the workforce for a transition into a renewable energy industry. Now, that doesn't mean next year. That doesn't mean in 5 or 10 years. We have to be much smarter about how this industry operates.
There is no doubt that a transition into renewable energy will take time. But voters are also worried about the effects on the economy. Currently, the United States national debt is nearing a staggering $29 trillion.
When we talk about lowering the debt ceiling, I think we have to start talking about a smart tax policy that really lifts up the middle class, right? The top corporations in this country that are paying zero in taxes, that are using existing loopholes in the tax code to essentially make away like bandits with millions of our taxpayer dollars. I think that's the first place that we need to address when we talk about cutting the deficit. Now, I'll say Republicans were perfectly fine increasing the debt ceiling when it was a tax cut for the rich, but they are not supportive when Democrats want to champion programs, social programs that help lift up the middle class.
With New Mexico's 2nd Congressional District being one of the geographically largest in the country, Vasquez says that he looks forward to the challenge.
The census numbers just came out, and Doña Ana County in particular is now over 67% Hispanic. We are the largest per capita Hispanic state in the entire country. And as you mentioned, we are a melting pot of communities. Congressional District 2 includes currently both Native American communities, Zuni, Laguna Pueblos, as well as very rural communities. It's really what makes this district beautiful. It's why we're called the Land of Enchantment.
As for right now, Vasquez's campaign is focusing on fundraising events as well as attending local protests and demonstrations.
It takes money to run a congressional campaign, and in fact, this was one of, if not the most expensive House race in the last congressional cycle. That's not lost on me, and we also live in the second poorest state in the country, right? And so it really requires everybody to chip in. It requires individuals to really believe in the vision that you offer as a candidate.
New Mexico's 2nd Congressional District is expected to be one of the most competitive in the nation next year. With all eyes on southern New Mexico, Gabe Vasquez will be at the center of attention. For KRWG Public Media, this is Noah Race reporting.
Well, getting more young people to vote is a major focus in New Mexico and across the nation. In depth, here's KRWG Public Media scholar Sarah Rodriguez.
Activists are working to increase voter turnout among young people. In the 2020 election, less than half of young eligible registered voters actually voted. New Mexico State University student Nevaeh Torres Carrillo says the 2020 election was her first time at the polls.
The last election was actually the first one I voted in, and then I do plan on voting in the future elections.
Young eligible voters are identified in the age group of 18 to 24 years old. The 2020 election saw a 48% youth voter turnout, which is an increase from the 2016 election's 39.4%. Nevaeh says her motivation came from candidates that shared her values.
I think finding somebody that has the same values as you and knowing that they're going to make a difference for like not only your life, but like the people like after us too. So I think it kind of motivates us to go out and vote to like have our say-so just by filling out a piece of paper.
Studies have shown that young eligible voters can be socially influenced to vote, meaning that if their friends don't vote, then they won't vote. Nevaeh doesn't see voting as a trend.
I don't think it should be like a trend. I think it should be like whenever you feel ready to vote, because it shouldn't be based on like what other people are doing or what other people believe either.
Social media plays a big role in civic activism, but students say the motivation to vote goes beyond what they see on their social media feed. NMSU student Paige Estrada says, like other generations, hers is fighting for change.
I think something that has really encouraged us, it sounds crazy, but it's definitely not social media that's influenced us. It's seen that we want to make a change in our future, and for those after us as well, our future generations, we want them to have a change. And in order to have our voice heard so we can progress and keep moving forward rather than being held back, and also let minorities also have a voice as well, which I think is really important too.
But to vote for change, you have to learn which candidates are pushing for change. NMSU student Eli Baca says gaining access to candidate information is easier than ever.
I think in the digital age of information, it's the easiest we've ever had it. We can turn on our phones, go through any news app, any website, and find whatever information we're looking for.
Although political information is sometimes easy to access, Estrada says it's difficult to find unbiased information.
I think it's definitely been difficult just because you have the different news networks, and obviously a lot of them are biased based off of their parties. So it's hard to find one that is a neutral ground, but once you do, I think that makes it a lot easier for you to figure out where you want to vote towards.
Baca says his drive to make a change is what motivates him to show up to the polls.
I think what motivates me to vote is looking for a change in my community, my state, and overall my nation.
So, what kind of change do young people support? A Harvard University poll of 18 to 29-year-old Americans show a majority back progressive values, with big increases in that support over the last 5 years. An 18-point increase in agreement with the statement that the government should do more to curb climate change, even at the expense of economic growth. 55% now support that statement. A 16-point increase in agreement with the idea that the government should spend more to reduce poverty. 61% now back that policy. And a 16-point increase in those who say that basic health insurance is a right for all people, and if someone has no means of paying for it, the government should provide it. 64% now support that idea. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Sarah Rodriguez.
Some Texas residents are raising concerns about new political maps a Republican lawmaker has proposed. Legislators held a hearing last weekend on the potential districts for the Texas Senate and the State Board of Education. Charlotte Reiser Harris lives in the Houston area. She told the State Senate Redistricting Committee the proposed political boundaries do not reflect the diverse population.
I urge this committee to design maps that comply with the Voting Rights Act, be brave and do what is necessary to give a voice to every Texan, no matter their race, how they vote, or where they live.
Texas lawmakers are redrawing political maps following the 2020 census, which found people of color drove 95% of the state's population growth over the last 10 years. David Albert is a professor at Austin Community College.
Most of the growth that has occurred in this state is in minority communities, particularly in the Hispanic community. If you are producing a just state map, state Senate map that will meet the standards of the Voting Rights Act, you should be drawing a plan with more minority opportunity districts, not less.
Of course, as we've been telling you, New Mexico is also redrawing maps. The Redistricting Committee meets Monday afternoon from 3 to 7 in the Senate Gallery at New Mexico State University's Corbett Center. That meeting is open to the public. We'll add Texas to the list of states taking another look at the 2020 election results. The Texas Secretary of State is auditing the 2020 results in Collin, Dallas, Harris, and Tarrant counties, despite no evidence of widespread voter fraud. That announcement came hours after former Republican President Donald Trump called for such a review in the state. He easily carried last year. It also comes after the Secretary of State's head of elections, Keith Ingram, told state lawmakers in March the election was secure.
I am happy to report that Texas elections are in good shape. Because of the hard work of county election officials across the state, the elections in Texas last year were a success.
Texas Republicans passed a raft of new voting restrictions into law in September, claiming that voter fraud was a significant problem, despite the fact that there is no evidence of that. Well, New Mexico lawmakers expect to grapple with juvenile justice again in the 2022 legislative session. Here's Roz Brown from the New Mexico News Connection.
A New Mexico legislator is optimistic that in the 2022 session, a bill will pass to prohibit life sentences for juveniles convicted of crimes. This year, a bill that would have ended life sentences and mandated earlier probation eligibility for juveniles easily passed in the Senate, but died without a vote in the House. As a juvenile justice advocate, Senator Bill O'Neill thinks teens who've committed crimes should get a parole hearing if they've shown signs of remorse or redemption.
If you're a juvenile, you are a child, and you should not be sentenced to life without parole. A person should be at least eligible if they've worked on their stuff and they committed a crime at age 16.
O'Neill previously sponsored a bill approved by the governor that prohibits private employers from inquiring about someone's criminal history on an initial job application. About 75 New Mexicans are currently serving sentences longer than 15 years for crimes they committed before they were 18, according to the New Mexico Coalition for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. O'Neill admits it's difficult to hear stories of victims of crimes committed by young people, but he notes the behavior often can be explained.
The perpetrator is oftentimes from a horrific upbringing, poverty, you know, drug abuse, sexual abuse, etc. So that behavior doesn't come out of left field.
The group, Leaders Organizing to Unite and Decriminalize, or LOUD, says to create a more fair and equitable juvenile justice system, policymakers need to do more to educate themselves about the experiences of young people who've been incarcerated. This is Ross Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. It's great to be with you. Las Cruces residents could soon be seeing a big increase in the price they pay for natural gas. The Utility Customer Advisory Group recently submitted its recommendations to the Las Cruces Utilities Board, but some are voicing concern. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
The Las Cruces Utilities Board is considering a natural gas rate increase after unanimously accepting a recommendation from the Utility Customer Advisory Group for review. Rate and Economic Analysis Manager Dominique Rodriguez reviewed how the increase will impact natural gas customers.
The UKEG is recommending to the Utilities Board an alternative phased-in approach over all customer classes where year one would increase by 20%. This would mitigate the cost of service increase while businesses recover, where year two and year three would have a 40% implementation.
Many members of the public voice concern over the proposed increase. Of the public responses received by the Utility Customer Advisory Group, 21 requested no increase, while 10 requested a full phased-in option. Members of the public also expressed issue with expanding natural gas lines to the Talavera subdivision. While Talavera residents themselves will be ultimately responsible for cost insulation within the subdivision, Las Cruces Utilities is also planning the installation of a high-pressure line to help with capacity and pressure needs for the entire city. The proposed Talavera expansion is something Richard Griffin, who spoke on behalf of the New Mexico Propane Gas Association, is against.
It allows a utility to expand into an area where it has no standalone economic justification for doing so. And really is what that means is that if the houses are too far apart, it just costs too much to run the gas line. And it doesn't make sense to do that.
Historically, the Las Cruces City Council has advocated for a transition away from natural gas, passing a climate action plan in October of 2020 and a resolution in April of 2021 calling for an energy transition plan. Las Cruces Utilities Director Delilah Walsh says that while staff is working to budget for the energy transition plan, the current system still needs to be maintained and staffing shortages need to be addressed.
Essentially, the rate review is covering the current demand to maintain the system as it exists today. So no matter what, we have to deliver a safe, reliable system. Our energy transition plan, and I want to remind the commissioners, that's something that you tasked us to do. We don't have it budgeted this year. We're trying to fit it into the budget at either mid-year or for our next budget. But that's going to take a couple of years. We're working with our sustainability officer to identify consultants. That's not going to happen tomorrow. The transition plan is a 30-year timeline.
While Commissioner Ioana Bencomo, who also sits on the Las Cruces City Council, voted to receive the recommendation for review, she says she does not support the final recommendation from the Utility Customer Advisory Group.
I think where I feel tension with that is that, I accept the work that the UCAG did. They did a lot of incredible work in ensuring they reached out to as many customers as possible. Where I have some tension with that is their final recommendation. Where I don't agree with that or accept the final recommendations.
Both Bencomo and Commissioner Gil Sorg, who represents District 5 on the City Council in addition to his duties on the Utility Board, advocated for an additional work session to review the proposed rate increase. Sorg says the board needs to thoroughly review each individual improvement.
I would like to see us go line by line through all of the capital improvement projects and show us where they are and why they're needed or not needed.
The board is expected to meet for a work session in October to review the recommendations. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
A network of shelters in the El Paso area is helping over 1,000 Haitian migrants. KTEP's Angela Cocherga has that story.
The nonprofit organization Annunciation House, with help from churches, is temporarily housing more than 1,200 migrants released in El Paso. They were moved last week from a squalid camp in Del Rio. Ruben Garcia, director of Annunciation House, is coordinating the response.
So this is an effort that is only possible because of all of these different churches, the vast majority, all of them staffed by volunteers.
Nearly 800 of the migrants are from Haiti. Many are parents with children like Mackinson, who does not want his last name used. He's traveling with his wife and 8-month-old baby, and he says he was relieved to have been released while his immigration case is decided rather than returned to Haiti. The Department of Homeland Security flew at least 4,000 migrants back to Haiti. While at Annunciation House, all of the migrants are tested for COVID and offered vaccines before they travel to their next destination. I'm Angela Cochergan, El Paso.
To commentary now, and some are expressing grave concerns about the Doña Ana County District Attorney's Office, including commentator Peter Goodman.
News reports in August said assistant DAs missed deadlines in four criminal cases within 2 weeks. That's four more than some lawyers miss in three decades. Asking around, I noticed everyone I spoke with who had contact with the district attorney's office had something very negative to say. Dumpster fire was a phrase I heard frequently. I was troubled. I like and respect D.A. Gerald Byers. He's smart and experienced, and even several critics say that he means well. I'd voted for him, hoping the employee lawsuits and unionization effort when he was deputy D.A. didn't mean too much. As I talked to former assistants, law enforcement, and others who have frequent contact with the D.A.'s office, they described an office that was dangerously understaffed. Attorneys were overworked and underpaid, high turnover was making things worse, and cases were being dropped or mishandled. Management also controlled more details of cases than usual, delaying resolution of cases. Just since Byers took over in January, more than a dozen prosecutors have left, six to other area DAs. Some still live here, commuting long hours, probably not because they love listening to audiobooks. I have reason to believe concerned observers have contacted the Attorney General. Some context. If Byers didn't inherit a sinking ship, he took command of one that was listing badly. For years, Susana Martinez, then Amy Orlando, ran the office. They prosecuted vigorously, but also hit defendants with excessive charges to compel plea bargains. When Mark D'Antonio won the 2012 election, he found things in surprising disarray, and many of Orlando's people fled elsewhere without even giving the new guy a chance. He wanted to balance vigorous prosecution with more openness to treatment when appropriate. But he seems not to have been a great administrator, and at first he trusted some people who maybe didn't deserve his trust. Byers largely ran the office for much of D'Antonio's second term, then was elected unopposed last year. Morale is reportedly poor. Three women recently received settlements based on allegations about Byers' work as chief deputy. That sparked the effort to unionize, rare among lawyers. Byers stresses that he treats everyone the same. This month, to everyone's surprise, he fired Chief Deputy A.J. Salazar, who has served formal notice he may sue. Byers has responses to each charge, and it's hard to assess these things from outside. But just the fact that so many refugees from our DA's office are prosecuting cases elsewhere raises serious questions. Because people avoid saying to Byers what they say to others, he's unaware of the extent of the criticism. Whatever has happened, and whoever bears how much fault, I hope Byers takes these concerns seriously and improves matters soon.
Peter Goodman's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. On the Health Watch this week, Ashley Brown is a registered nurse in the intensive care unit at St. Luke's Meridian Medical Center in Idaho. She recorded her thoughts as hospitals like hers become overwhelmed with COVID patients.
It's about 8 p.m. I just got home from work. That was a busy day. This morning when I walked in, we had a COVID patient in every single room on our 14-bed unit. I think the thing is like that it just, you may be doing like okay before you come into the unit. You know, I had meditated this morning. I had gone on a long walk. I was feeling good. And the last time I was in, there were, I think, 9 or 10 patients. And now we're up to 14. And I don't know, you just immediately feel this weight because you have this knowledge that really not normal to have all rooms with the same diagnosis. And the majority of those rooms are patients who are on ventilators because they cannot breathe. I spent kind of the first 30 minutes just trying to kind of gather myself because I immediately felt really anxious and very sad. So 14 COVID patients, one of them died today. I was not taking care of that patient. I was taking care of two of the other patients on the floor, one of whom is actually the youngest patient that I've taken care of so far. They're in their 30s and they have kids. I think that's been one of the things that has been new and different kind of this time around, is that it's a younger population and they have young kids, and it just sits with you differently because you know that there are young children who aren't going to grow up potentially with a parent. And granted, I think in this case, like, we don't know what the outcome is going to be, but she did not do well today. We tried to flip her on her back to see if she would breathe okay on her back, and it was immediately evident that she was not breathing well, and we had to flip her back over on her stomach. And then having to communicate that to the family, you know, is hard too, of just knowing that they want to hear good news and not being able to give it to them. That's hard. So today I decided maybe I would try recording some while I'm at work. So right now it's about 8:30 in the morning. And not much has changed overnight. A lot of us keep saying it's like deja vu. Same patients, haven't changed much. We just do it again. I've been thinking a lot about just our healthcare team, just how grateful I am for them. It's also just really nice to have people who have seen what you've seen and are frustrated, like the way that you're frustrated, or, you know, you cried yesterday and they cry today. Today is September 3rd. It's about 8 in the evening. I just got off of work. We had, I think, 10 COVIDs, because yesterday two died. I intubated this gal a couple days ago. I think it was Tuesday. And she died today. When I say intubated, I just mean that we put that tube down so that the patient can be on a vent. All of the patients that I do that to, and, you know, I'm like the last one of the last people that they talk to, it, they always sit with me a little bit more. I can think of faces and names of people, you know, this one in room 3, this one in room 4, room 6. And there are multiple people in each of those rooms that you remember that have passed on. There's just a part of me that just like wants to scream and be like, but this didn't have to be the case. All of the trauma that happens from getting this disease and being one of the unlucky ones that gets sick enough to end up in the ICU and pass away, it just seems so unnecessary. And it's hard not to be angry about that.
That was registered nurse Ashley Brown. This audio postcard came from the Mountain West News Bureau with funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. By the way, on Friday, I talked with Dr. Dolores Gomez of Memorial Medical Center in Las Cruces about COVID-19 and how the pandemic is affecting the city of Las Cruces and the hospitals here. You can listen to that program, Voice of the Public, under local radio at krwg.org. Well, now we're going to begin portions of the Las Cruces City Council forums. KRWG Public Media partnered with the League of Women Voters of Southern New Mexico on this project. This week, District 3 candidates Bev Courtney and Becky Graham. We begin by asking the candidates why are they running for city council, and here's Bev Courtney.
As you know, it's my third race, and I do it because I keep fighting for my Christian conservative values, and it seems like we keep getting away from the law that we've enjoyed for 200 plus years that give us freedom and liberty, and I am wanting to bring attention to our election process. Over the time that I have been in politics, I've been in court over the election process. I've watched the state gut the election laws that safeguard one citizen, one verified vote, and they just keep loosening up the laws. And free and fair elections are the foundation of a limited republic and the foundation of everything that we hold dear.
Thank you very much, Bev. Becky.
Thank you, Fred and Laura, for hosting us. I've lived in Las Cruces for more than 20 years, the last 15 of those in District 3. I did my master's and PhD work at NMSU, and that's where I've launched my career. I would bring to the council more than a decade of economic development experience. I have researched, designed, and implemented programs that try to advance prosperity for the state of New Mexico, but especially right here in the borderland. I've also been an English instructor at DACC for several years, and that really gave me the opportunity to meet people coming from our community, coming from District 3, many of them from low and moderate income households. And I see firsthand how hard they're willing to work in a system that often doesn't really allow them to get ahead. What really pushed me to seek a council seat has been the last year and a half of COVID. I'm the wife and the daughter of frontline COVID workers.
Thank you very much, Becky. We're out of time. Laura.
Becky, this question goes to you first. What experiences have contributed to your qualifications for city council?
So as I mentioned, I have more than 10 years of experience in regional economic development. A lot of that has been based in entrepreneurship and small business development, and especially finding ways to bring folks who have been traditionally underrepresented in small business into the fold. So that is working with women, working with racial and ethnic minorities, working with lower income folks. And as I also mentioned, I feel like I have a strong base in the community through my time at DACC, where I had the opportunity to see people from throughout the region of all ages, some right out of high school, some lifelong learners. And I think that those one-on-one interactions with such a broad base of people have really given me insight into this community, made me love it more, and made me want to serve.
Thanks, Becky. Bev?
Hello. My experience is raising my kids in District 3. I have two kids that are doctors that are on the front lines with working with COVID, and one that's a nurse. And District 3 has lacked prosperity most of the time that I've lived there. And so basic things like infrastructure and jobs for the people has been lacking. District 3 is worse now than it was 4 years ago. There's more people on the streets, more empty buildings. There's no jobs. We need a change. And I bring traditional capitalism, which capitalist lets the money stay with the people, and that gives them hope of reward. It's freedom of choice, and getting a job and working under the threat of violence from the government, it takes away motivation for the business owner.
Thank you. Thank you, Bev. We're out of time on that question. A follow-up, Bev, we begin with you on this. What is the role of city government in addressing poverty? Explain, Bev.
Well, they invite companies in that will hire people. They lower taxes, lower regulations, finding there's jobs out there, we just need to bring them to us. And that is, there's all kinds of creative ways to bring jobs to the community. Also, there's all these empty buildings down there. You have to give them incentives to help people be entrepreneurs. I know I didn't say that right, but to help them want to be startup businesses, help them want to be, have pride in their own community, and you know, support their neighbor, their neighbors and their neighborhood. The city's job is safety and security. So when you have homelessness like we do right now, I don't know where they all came from, it brings in crime, it discourages a safe, happy feeling on the street.
Thank you very much, Bev. Becky?
I agree that things like infill development policies, zoning that's going to incentivize moving new small businesses into perhaps, you know, existing vacant buildings, I think all of those can be extremely important. But I also agree in a more direct person-to-person role to deal with poverty in the community. I've looked a lot into the talks around guaranteed basic income that are going on in the city council and in the larger community. If we look at the US average, a minimum wage worker needs to work 79 hours a week to afford a one bedroom rental, 97 hours a week to afford a two bedroom rental. So living paycheck to paycheck on a minimum wage job is like running really hard on a treadmill. You work so hard, but you don't get anywhere.
Becky Graham and Bev Courtney, candidates for District 3 in Las Cruces for City Council. You can watch that entire forum tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV. You'll also find it right now on the Newsmakers page in the local TV section at krwg.org. Well, speaking of the Las Cruces City Council, the council reviewed the status of current GO Bond projects during a work session this week. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
The city of Las Cruces is making progress on current GO Bond projects, with over 40% of total construction completed. While the city originally projected progress to be closer to 46% completion, Public Works Director David Cedillo anticipates that the gap will close within the next quarter. According to Cedillo, one project near completion is a replacement facility for Fire Station 3, located on North Valley Drive.
That project is about 63% complete. The estimated completion date is January 20th of 2022. Now that the shell has been built and they're working on stuccoing the building, there's a lot of the interior utilities, such as HVAC, electrical, fire protection, plumbing, all of those continue to be worked on and are getting close to being completed.
Cedillo estimates that all current GO Bond projects will be completed by the end of 2022. That includes the new $9.8 million Animal Services Center, which is estimated to be finished in September. Mayor Ken Miyagashima says he's proud of the way city employees have kept projects moving during the pandemic.
I have to admit, it was a little bit challenging there, and you guys didn't stop. You just kept on working. And yeah, I remember that, and that to me was really significant.
Already, the city has completed work on one GO Bond project, the Hadley Recreation Complex. Councilor Tessa Beda-Stuvey says the city must capitalize on the successful completion of GO Bond projects with public information campaigns.
As we do finish these projects, we want to make sure that they're very visible and very public. And when we have these successes, that things are done early, that we're showcasing that we need the community to really buy into these projects.
The City Council also discussed plans for future GO Bond projects during the work session. While the city is still in the process of identifying just what those projects will look like, Councilor Joanna Bencomo says she'll be fighting for affordable housing.
I'm already going to start pushing for affordable housing projects
in this next GO bond cycle, just because I think it's key, it's priority. We know that our neighbors in Albuquerque have done this. I wonder if we can approach this GO bond cycle in order to meet the biggest challenges facing the city.
If the current tax rate is maintained, the city will have $23 million for GO bond projects following the 2022 election cycle. Mayor Miyagashima indicated he does not want to see a tax increase.
There's a lot to say when vote for this GO bond, it's not going to increase your taxes. I mean, that's a tremendous opportunity to explain to the residents and let them know that we're not going to increase it, and yet we still get benefit of $23 million.
Councillor Abeta Stuvi is also advocating for the tax rate to stay the same, citing the ongoing pandemic as one reason residents should not be burdened with higher taxes.
Given the last 2 years and the climate and the way that people have struggled in this last time, I don't necessarily think it's a wise plan to increase anything, even though I know we could definitely use it and there's so many projects that we want to see. Perhaps after this other cycle, it would be something to think about and maybe think about increasing it into the $35 million zone. But for right now, we need to show that we've delivered on the first set of GO bonds well. And then as we're asking to reissue, having us say it's not going to raise your taxes at all.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
And join us for the very latest from the Las Cruces City Council every Tuesday on KRWG News at 7:45 and 4:44 in the afternoon. KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. It's great to be with you on this Saturday evening. Mended Wings, true stories about the Vietnam War experience through the eyes of 10 American Purple Heart helicopter pilots. It's a new book, and Emily Guerra spoke with the New Mexico State University alum who wrote it, Colin Cahoon.
Tell us about your background and your military service.
Well, I grew up in the Mesilla Valley. I went to Gadsden High School, graduated in 1979, and then on to New Mexico State University, where I majored in chemical engineering and was an ROTC cadet as well. And I graduated from NMSU in 1983, was commissioned in the Army and as a second lieutenant. And then from there, I went into flight school and Fort Rucker, Alabama. I did a little stint at Fort Bliss before that. And then I served at Fort Ord, California in the 7th Infantry Division as an attack helicopter battalion. And did active duty for about 5 years and Guard and Reserve for a couple years after that.
When and how did you get the idea to write the book?
So when I was in flight school, it was 1984 and Fort Rucker, and all of the instructor pilots, the civilian instructor pilots, were Vietnam veterans. And we used to go out on the flight line and we were flying the old Huey Warbirds. You could see the bullet holes that had been left in them. They were all patched with little 1-inch square patches. And I'd go out there with the instructor pilots and they'd see an aircraft and say, oh, you know, that's an aircraft I flew when I was in Vietnam in the CAV or whatever. And I really looked up to these guys. I thought they had amazing stories. When I got to my unit at Fort Ord, the senior warrant officers and all the field grade officers were all Vietnam vets. And I just really looked up to them. They made me the best helicopter pilot I could be, the best officer I could be. They were my heroes. And I just thought, even way back then in the 1980s, that somebody needed to write a book that did honor to these guys and told their stories. And it really just took me a long time to get around to it, unfortunately. I did start writing books, but I had to break genre to write this because I wanted to do it while we still had these guys around to say thank you to. So that's kind of where I got the idea to do it.
Was that your purpose in writing Mended Wings?
Yes, it was. I really wanted to honor these guys that had done so much for me. And I think that, as you know, Emily, the Vietnam vets were not treated very well when they came home. And I think it's really until maybe the last 10, 15 years that we've started paying them respect and telling them thank you for their service and really saying welcome home. And I think it's important for the following generations to understand what this generation of helicopter pilots went through and what their experiences were, what their lives were like back then and what their lives were like after the war and what their lives are like now. And that's the purpose of the book.
How did you find the veterans that you write about in Mended Wings?
Well, that's a great question. How do you go about doing that? There's an organization called the Vietnam Helicopter Pilots Association that puts out a publication every 2 months called The Aviator. And I just put an ad in there and said, if you were wounded in combat flying helicopters in Vietnam, would you be interested in telling your life story? And I got about 20 guys answered the ad, and we went through an initial screening process. And then eventually we narrowed it down to 10 of them. I did between 6 and 12 hours of interviews with each one of these guys. I talked to the pilots they flew with, talked to their families, did research as much as I could on the events. And eventually it just all came together, 10 stories chronologically about guys who flew in combat in Vietnam.
How were you able to get the veterans in your book to open up about their stories?
Well, I think it helped that I was a helicopter pilot myself, so I could speak the language to them, and I flew some of the same aircraft that they flew in. And I think maybe my age, I'm 59 years old, so I was a kid when the Vietnam War was going on, but I knew people older than me that who went, and so I think they looked at me kind of like their kid brother once I was able to gain their confidence. And they started to kind of open up and tell me things that they really hadn't told anybody before, which became evident, Emily, when I would send them the drafts, because some of these guys wouldn't send them back for 4 to 6 weeks or 8 weeks. And then they'd finally get back to me and say, well, Colin, you really got it right. I really appreciate you telling my story, but there's things in here I'm not sure you can tell anyone because I've never told anyone, not even my wife. So there's a lot of really deep, heartfelt things that are expressed in that book that I think I'm very proud that these guys were able to come forward and tell us about it.
And you can catch Emily's entire interviews anytime. Look for Puentes under the news tab at krwg.org. Finally this week, a story that we played on KRWG News, and it has been generating a lot of interest. I found this one my favorite story of the week, actually. The Texas Republican Party is in a fight with big tech. We've been reporting on this. The legislature passed a bill that prevents so-called deplatforming, where users are banned from YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. But as Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav reports, the statements about protecting the First Amendment have been increasingly at odds with the actions of elected Republican leaders.
Republican Texas legislators were so concerned about conservatives being banned from Facebook and YouTube and Twitter that they passed a bill.
Freedom of speech is under attack in Texas.
Governor Abbott signed the bill into law earlier this month. It would allow Texans and the state's attorney general to sue social media companies who ban users for their political views.
It is now law that conservative viewpoints in Texas cannot be banned on social media.
But Republicans in the state have been notably aggressive this last year themselves, banning other points of view. The legislature passed a bill banning how teachers can talk about current events and systemic racism in the classroom. The so-called critical race theory bill has been attacked by a number of educators and historians, like Texas A&M history professor Armando Alonso.
Once you start making prohibitions and restricting the ability of the teacher to discuss particularly things that may be controversial, I think that that's getting into a dangerous area of censorship.
The bill banning CRT wasn't the only one concerned with how Texas history is talked about. The so-called 1836 Project would provide a patriotic history through official committee pamphlets.
We must never forget why Texas became so exceptional in the first place. A law creating the 1836 Project does that.
Historians like Alonzo argue the bill is an overreaction to the nation's moves to highlight and address systemic racism, and says it will likely gloss over the negative parts of the state's complex history, like the violent history of the Texas Rangers at the border, or years of racist legislation passing in the Texas Statehouse, and forget the 100 years of Texas history that occurred before 1836.
resembles some of the dictatorships that, you know, that we are familiar with, and even in a recent past, you know, where you have nation states that only teach the history the way they want to teach it.
The 1836 Project and all of these bills about what parts of Texas history are allowed and not allowed come straight out of the Soviet Union.
Author and Houston Chronicle columnist Chris Tomlinson says elected leaders have been aggressively trying to tamp down on discussions about race in Texas histories. So when he hears the governor talk about conservative voices being silenced.
Well, my first thought is that Governor Abbott and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick oppressed my free speech when they canceled the book talk we had scheduled at the Bullock Museum just 3 hours before we were to take the stage.
His book, Forget the Alamo, examines the role of maintaining slavery in the state's battle for independence. The lieutenant governor admitted to pressuring the museum to cancel, calling the book a rewriting of history. Tomlinson says state elected leaders see the demographics of the state becoming more Hispanic and are trying to tap into white fear of change to get people to the polls. And an ad targeting those same voters was recently pulled from a University of Texas football game. Anti-Trump conservative activist The Lincoln Project bought a 60-second ad during the UT Rice game. The ad was called Abbott's Wall and featured a line of caskets while a ticker counted off 60,000 Texans dead from COVID, criticizing Abbott's handling of the pandemic. Lincoln Project co-founder Reed Galen says they found out about 10 minutes before kickoff that it had been pulled by the university, which co-owns the network. He says he believes the governor, who appoints the Board of Regents, had it pulled.
Again, I think it's just highly convenient that an ad that is disparaging and highlighting of his failure suddenly somehow disappears from the air.
The governor's office referred our questions about the issue to the governor's campaign, which flatly denied allegations they had anything to do with the ad being pulled. University of Texas officials have not responded to multiple emails from Texas Public Radio, but in a recording of a faculty council meeting, Provost Sharon Wood said the ad was pulled Friday by the company Learfield, which handles all national ad placements for the network.
So for over a decade, Learfield has followed a standing policy of not selling political advertisements other than candidate ads. And it is our understanding that Learfield pulled this particular advertisement on Friday evening, which is consistent with this longstanding policy.
Wood did not explain why the ad was sold to begin with. Learfield did not respond to TPR questions, including a request for the policy the ad violated. Regardless of this one ad, freedom of speech may be under attack in Texas, but increasingly, it's not by who the governor says it is. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
That's KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. For the latest news, stay with us anytime. We are there for you at KRWG.org. Hey, and we'd like to hear from you, too. You can send your local viewpoints columns for the website to feedback@NMSU. Also use that email address for story ideas, for comments, for questions, you name it. feedback@nmsu.edu. I'm Fred Martino, broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, and KRXG Silver City. KRWG Public Media, the New Mexico Broadcasters Association Station of the Year, thanks to your support. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.